am Dan Dunford, and happy tax day, I suppose. Hope you're getting a nice refund today, and or are not paying too much, because taxes are annoying. Anyway, really cool episode this week. The guest this week is Calliope Brass. Three of the musicians of Calliope Brass came and sat down with me earlier this week to record an interview. Those three musicians were horn player Aaron Paul, and no, before you ask, no, that's not Breaking Bad Aaron Paul, it's E-R-I-N, so there's that, as well as trombonist Sarah Mayo and bass trombonist Jen Hinkle, all of who are wonderful brass players. Calliope Brass is also made up of Jean Lorenz and Rebecca Steinberg and Andrea Neumann. And they are all wonderful musicians, and as you may have noticed by their names, they're all women, which we discuss heavily in this interview. And it's, you know, the, when we discuss this, but there's like this, there's a difficulty with having an all women group in that, you know, if the group wants to their art to be in the forefront, other people still want to make it about the fact that it's a group made up of all women, which in the brass community is fairly rare. There are notable exceptions, but overall it's very rare. But we cover as much as we could. We had a really fun conversation. Sat down and talked for a good 2 hours. Now, I did cut that down to less than an hour and a half, which I think the length I ended up with works out really nicely. But, you know, we talk about the group. We talk about the music. And, of course, we talk about the issues that women who play brass instruments face on a daily basis, starting from an early age, and there's really no way around it. It's the thing that doesn't get discussed that often, and, you know, it's like I say later in the interview, it's the elephant in the room, and it would be silly not to address it. But anyway, as far as performances go, they'll be playing a show on April 25th at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, which is in Manhattan at 20 Cumming Street. We talk about the concert and the show. It's going to be really cool. So April 25th, the concert starts at 7 p.m. So show up for that. All right, do it. But other than that, please enjoy my interview with the women of Calliope Brass. And if you enjoy it, hit subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher and let me know what you think. Shoot me an email at divergentpathspod@gmail.com or hit me up on Facebook. Facebook.com/divergentpathspod. Great. All right. Have a great week. Thank you guys for coming up here to do this. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Well, honestly, here's the thing to start out with. Especially in New York, but in really any city larger than, say, no, and I'm not even gonna make that qualification. Basically, any city, like there's always a heavy load of brass quintets as ensemble units. It's like the most popular brass group. It's easily wielded, if you will. And you know, that's kind of the base thing you get to when you're with a group of brass players. It's like, oh, we're buddies, let's get together and make a brass quintet. We can like play weddings and shit. make some easy money. And the funny thing is I was, you know, a person that I know, a brass player that all of you probably know as well, just got like became part of this other brass quintet based out of a different city. And I was like, oh, I haven't heard of this quintet. And I clicked on it and it was just like the same spiel as pretty much every other one. It was just like looking for new ways to expand brass music and show what everyone else can do, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, I've come to the conclusion that brass quintets are like Instagram filters. It's like you can swear up and down that Hudson is like better than Toast, but as far as I'm concerned, they all basically look the same. So that being all of that being said, why in a situation where there's so many, why throw your hat into the ring as another option?
That's a
Like,
really
I mean, that's
good.
just I you know,
I
this
love
is
this
not this is nothing
description.
against like against the brass quintet as a unit or against any specific one. I'm just curious, like,
No, but with
why
so
do
many out there, why make another one?
Yeah, and we definitely, this is something that we talked about
Yeah,
because I
for
think
sure.
several of us, myself especially, had no interest in being another quintet that plays Ewald and is
That's a running joke.
competing. Yeah, it is a running joke.
Let's play Ewald.
Let's, yeah, everybody, let's you know, I mean, and there's
We'll
nothing
really
against
show people what
Ewald.
we can do by playing Ewald 3 again.
Yeah, for the
because nobody has
950th
heard
time.
Ewald 3. And, you know, also just, yeah, competing for the same gigs, competing for the same audience of no one. Let's be honest, you know, I
those
mean, you,
$150 wedding gigs are.
yeah, really a reason to deal with all the hassle. But, you know, I think that was something that we really talked about when we first started was, well, you know, it's fun to get together and play, but if you're actually going to bother with creating a group, then you need to change the demographic of who you are attempting to get as your audience, or else you're just one more brass quintet that's out there playing the same repertoire for the same group of people, and it's not an enormous pool to choose from. Because let's just be totally honest, I don't go to a lot of brass quintet concerts, and you know, because usually I'm like, oh, what are they playing? I can pretty much imagine what that's going to sound like already, based on
It's
who's in the group, what the pieces are.
half the time it looks like a chamber recital, a conservatory chamber recital. It's the same rep. I can't even remember the last time I went to a brass quintet concert. It was probably like Manhattan Brass, like 3 or 4 years ago.
Right. Yeah,
And so there's not a lot that's compelling about that. There's not a lot that's compelling about that theatrically. There's not a lot that's compelling about that musically. Let's just be totally honest. A lot of the brass quintet repertoire is schmaltzy. It's fluff, which is fine. There's a place for fluff, and fluff is great. And you know, and that's not saying we're above playing fluff because you know, we can be bought. So, you know.
Let's be totally honest. I mean, if someone comes to you with a wedding gig, it's
Oh,
the pay's
yeah.
okay. You're not going to say
Absolutely.
no.
Absolutely. But
No,
but to
but if
me
that's
that's
your that can't
but
be your core of existence.
right, exactly. So, I mean, to me, if you want to create a business out of it, like the business model, you know, you can't just be one more quintet that's like throwing their hat into the ring for the same five gigs. You have to create a new audience, first of all. You have to find a way of bringing in a new audience because the kinds of people who go out and see specifically brass quintet concerts, that's a pretty small demographic.
Yeah, I mean,
You know, I mean, that's, and
but there's a
especially with
reason
so
that
many.
the very successful quintets tour so much. You have to go to
Well,
that audience.
But even like among those, like the standard bearers of the brass quartet, like Canadian brass isn't even the Canadian brass anymore. Yes, they're still the same. It's still the same group. I mean, it's the same tuba player. I mean, and they still have the same name. They do the same things, but they're not the full-time ensemble that they were 20 years ago. Like, mm-hmm. and that's like the absolute peak of the mountain. Like,
right.
Like, you're not going to get more popular. Most people probably aren't going to get more popular than that. And even they don't do what they used to do.
Right.
Yeah. But they still tour. Like, because, like you said. Like you said, you have to go to where the audiences are. Otherwise, right. like, it would, or you have to continue changing what it is that you do.
Right.
So that, you know, you can, like, build a following that will keep coming to see you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, like a group like Minozal Brass has really, mm-hmm. they've really incorporated theatrical external factors, aside from the fact that they're fantastic brass players. They've incorporated a lot of different things to turn it into more of a show than a concert.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really speaks to a lot of people. There's a lot of interest in that sort of experience where you have multiple things going on in addition to the music. Sitting on a stage in five chairs and playing isn't as compelling as maybe it was 30 years ago.
And I think in a culture where we have so much access now, more access than we've ever had. And I think that there is more of a call, more access to media. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess I should be specific.
Yeah, if you want to hear a specific piece played by brass quintet, you can go on YouTube and listen to 9,000 different quintets play it.
Yeah, and so I think there's also this, to get somebody to go out and pay money, there has to be a compelling, interesting reason to do that. Because otherwise, I'm trying to think of how I'm going to phrase this. Like, the sorts of things that we see now in consuming media are so kind of sensory overload that I think a lot of times, if you're just going and watching people sitting in chairs playing music, people are like, well, if I was at home, I could listen to this and I could be like also doing this other thing at the same time. You know what I'm saying? Or, you know, and so you're sort of seeing some of these things that take maybe a higher level of like focus concentration on one element sort of going away for better or for worse, you know, and and if you don't adapt to that, you know, we've seen the effects of what happens, you know, with that all over, like across every single genre of the arts.
Well,
you
it's,
know?
I mean, and this might be like a referendum on my own ability to focus on things, but I don't know. I rarely go and see orchestras play anymore. Like I'm just, and only then if it's free, because Philharmonic's too expensive, and I don't, you know, I'm not that interested. It's, you know, they're good at what they do, whatever. But the last 3-4 times I've gone to see them, I've definitely fallen asleep, like, first half.
Yeah.
Like, even,
I've always fallen, I'm gonna admit
like,
something, 100%. I've always fallen asleep in orchestra concerts.
It's
great music, but you're
sometimes
sitting and you're not, well, sure. Assuming that it's great music and it's an amazing performance, you're still sitting and not doing anything.
I fall asleep when I'm playing orchestra concerts.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of,
I fall asleep just about anywhere.
11 that
o'clock,
is true.
Boom.
That
in
is
a
true.
Bar.
In
a
bar.
Restaurant,
this has happened multiple
at a friend's
times.
House. I'm famous for my naps. But even before I turn into a pumpkin, if I'm sitting somewhere that's warm and there's wonderful sounds, you know, I mean, it's really hard not to. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a time and place and an audience for all those things. But that being said, like you're saying, there's so many brass quintets. There's so many, so much of the same.
Mm-hmm.
That in order to, strictly speaking as a business model, like you were kind of talking about before, you have to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. I mean, I've watched a lot of Shark Tank, right? If you go on Shark Tank and you bring in, for real though, it's you have to think like this even with music. If you go in on Shark Tank and you bring in something that has no proprietary value and is not doing anything differently, Kevin O'Leary will shut you down. And he'll tell you that he can get, you know, such and such manufacturer in China to reverse engineer whatever it is that you've made without a patent and make it cheaper.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about wedding gigs and all these kinds of things, there are students who will play. There are, you know, grad students who can form a quintet and go post on Gigmasters and play, and maybe they'll play for half the price that you would want to get as a little bit of an older professional. So you have to have a value added.
And there are contractors who take advantage of that.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's capitalism, baby. That's the system we're in, unfortunately, for better or for worse.
America!
Yeah, I mean, that's the way the world works. And books. To ignore the way that the world works, and you continue to bash your head against the wall and get frustrated without changing what you're doing. The definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. So if you don't adapt and overcome, as my dad would say, then you're setting yourself up for failure. And so I feel like a lot of people graduate from music school and they try to just kind of do the thing that makes sense, like that.
You said the definition of insanity was doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I thought that was just preparing for an orchestra audition.
Yes, but truly, you know.
Yeah, are they doing right?
Yeah, I mean, we're throwing a lot of shade, guys. We're only 10 minutes in.
10 minutes in, well, we've bashed orchestral auditions, Ewald, every brass quintet.
I do love
awesome.
Ewald.
We do love Ewald. So sorry.
No, no, but really, I mean, if you find yourself, some people can handle the slog mm-hmm. of orchestral auditions.
It takes a very specific kind of focus. Mm-hmm. That's
and
all.
Some people are really good at it. Mm-hmm. And some people win multiple jobs. And some people... But if you can't do that, and if that's not who you are, that doesn't mean that you can't do anything. And so, you know, and sure, you can go out and start a brass quintet, but you don't necessarily have to do like the, okay, we got the group together, we rehearse once a week, here's our book of 9,000 pieces that we play at weddings, you know, like let's... record a couple things and put up some pictures and let's go for it. I mean, that can be part of what you do, and that's certainly part of what we've done. Because playing a show like the one that we're playing obviously isn't bringing in the big bucks, and everybody needs to make money because we live in an expensive city. And well, anyway, you have to differentiate yourself in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And even when you're talking about something like creative work and art, mm-hmm. if you would like to make a living doing it, which I think the five of us agree that we would. We don't want to just do things for free. You have to find a way to make yourself different and draw the audience to you. And the way that we have gone about doing that has been to incorporate some of these more theatrical and multimedia elements into the traditional brass quintet. So instead of walking in and having a concert where we're just going to blow through five charts, everybody knows, kind of a deal, we wanted to create something that speaks to something that we care about, speaks to things that we care about, I should say.
This would probably, after like 16 minutes, this is probably a good point to be like, so the people of Calliope Brass Quintet that are here at the moment.
Yes.
everyone's not here.
Right.
But there's Aaron Paul, horn player, who has been talking constantly for the past 10 minutes. Oh,
ouch.
I'm just kidding.
So
kidding.
Shade.
Jesus.
So shade.
It's supposed to be fun. It's a fun experience, guys. Sarah Mayo plays trombone.
What's up?
She doesn't talk a lot.
She says what's up.
Yeah.
She has a sweet red streak in her hair. It's all right.
She's a strong, silent type.
With great for a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two things that are great for podcasts: strong, silent people and hand motions.
And we've all got faces made for radio.
And Jen Hinkle, who plays bass trombone, who has also been talking regularly. And then there's the members of the group who aren't here right now, which is Becca Steinberg and Jean Lawrence.
Lorenz. Jean Lawrence. She's a
also
hot
plays
shot,
trumpet.
Hotshot trumpet player all the way from France. There's a good story about that.
But she's not from France?
No, she's a girl from Chicago.
Yeah.
But her name can come across
about.
As what was the story? She went to audition somewhere and...
Or no, she was playing a solo, I think, at a festival.
Yeah,
she got hired
like
at a festival and they thought she was a guy from France named Jean Laurence. And so she showed up and she's like, hey guys, like all, you know, like I'm ready to play with you.
Yeah, I think so she's like,
in the Midwest, what up?
Yeah. And they're like, who are you? And you're like, I'm Jean. Oh, you know.
It's a good one.
So for people who are listening, you may or may not have noticed that all five people are women. Hooray.
Even Jean Laurence.
Even the French, the male French virtuoso Jean Laurence is actually a woman. which, I mean, well, it's an important thing to talk about. It's unusual. I mean, there are a few women, female only, whatever, brass quintets. Not that many, not nearly as many as there are just like five dudes drinking beer brass quintets.
Right.
I don't know. There's a couple. I guess Seraph Brass is one. But there's another one like Stiletto. Is that right? Yeah.
Stiletto Brass.
Anyway, but the fact that I had to like really dig for the second one in my brain kind of, you know, illustrates the fact that there just aren't that many.
Right.
I mean, part of that is straight up from the idea that like brass playing in America and in Europe and everywhere else is a traditionally male dominated field. But as I've realized recently in New York, there's like this female brass mafia. It's crazy.
We're coming to get
I'm
you.
Like, I don't, I tread very carefully so I don't get like hit. No, that's a joke.
There's a guy that's outside a right now.
There's a guy outside?
I'm sorry, you're all outside.
Come on. You're killing my whole thing. No, but now, I mean, it might seem kind of hack to like focus on that, but it's a fact.
It's unusual.
It's an outlier. There we go. That's the word I was looking for. Thanks, Malcolm Gladwell.
Right.
But it is an outlier in a brass community. Now, was that like the intention going forward? From the jump.
Starting out. So I kind of started this whole thing. It's not really a big deal, whatever. I'm the visionary. No, not really. Well, when I was living in Las Vegas, I was friends with one of the players from Vegas, and I got familiar with that whole scene. And I really thought it was interesting that in the world of touring brass quintets that are doing shows that are not strictly educational focused, that especially the big names, there might have been a female horn player in there at some point, like with the Empire Brass. I think they had a female member at one point.
At one point, but like,
yeah, but
Canadian Brass never.
Yeah, woman. Exactly. And
a lot of the Center City, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. A lot of, but yeah, the point being that, yeah,
it's really unusual. If there's going to be a woman in a quintet, it's usually the horn player. So not like I'm anything, you know, being the one who started it. I had the least distance to go, I guess you could say. But I noticed that there weren't any women, and I had a conversation at one point, and you know, it kind of came out that, well, you know, it would kind of throw off the dynamic. It would not necessarily throw off in a bad way, but it would change the dynamic of a group if it's all men touring together on the road, in hotels, in a bus, in the car, that kind of a deal. You know, throwing a woman into the mix might elicit discomfort from all sides. That might be something, I'm trying to politely say, it might get weird. So I've wondered since then, and he didn't have any malicious intent or to say like, oh, having a girl in the boys club would ruin everything. But I think he meant it in a way that, you know, when you're working in what chamber group is essentially a marriage, right? And so introducing, when you're in that situation, because of the tradition of brass being like a guy's thing that goes back hundreds of years, it doesn't always occur to someone who's in a brass quintet that happens to be all guys just because statistics has brought them there. Hey, maybe we should make it a point to bring in some women. And so for me, my idea was I want to start a brass quintet that just happens to be all women, but that happens to be all women, but that's not the focus of the group. Mm-hmm. Because with a lot of the female brass quintets, the differentiation factor is it's all women. Mm-hmm. Hey, look, a bunch of girls playing trumpets. That's weird. We should go see that. You know?
That becomes the marketing point, as opposed to what they're doing as an ensemble. Yeah.
Well, exactly. It's a struggle. I mean, like, I'm, from my point of view, mm-hmm. not from the perspective of like being in a quintet, but like trying to talk about it, like, oh, am I just asking them to interview them because it's all women? I mean, and to be honest, yeah, of course that's part of it, because it's some, but not because of the women thing, it's because of the it's something different thing, right? You know what I mean? Like, but also like broaching a subject like that, it a lot of times the focus does shift away, and this happens in the media and everything else, the focus shifts away from, like, yeah, like you said, the actual music and the art that you're creating, and focuses on the fact that, you know, oh great, these people are striking out for rights and such, right. And it's like, okay, well, I mean, that's part of it or whatever, but when it comes down to it, like, the centerpiece of any chamber ensemble, no matter the makeup, has to be the product,
right?
Or
exactly.
Else, like, right, the gimmick, like, yeah. without calling, you know, I'm using gimmick as a shorthand,
right.
But the gimmick gets old fast if there's nothing to prop it up,
right? You don't want to have, and you don't want your gimmick to be, hey, look, I was born with a vagina, how exciting, you know?
It's like, pretty exciting
for some, not all, but
anyway.
No, but you know, you don't want it to turn into, hey, like I said, hey, look, a bunch of girls playing brass instruments, that's weird, we should go see this, that's unusual. What we wanted to do is normalize that.
Yes.
You know, here's a brass quintet, they're doing something different, they're changing the way that the music is used, the way that the ensemble's used, they're adding new elements to the presentation. Oh, P.S., it's all girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which was sort of the vibe that I wanted to go for. We, you know, when I had the idea to get the group together and was trying to figure out what to do, and, you know, I just wanted to get people in a room to read first. Mm. That was the first step. And I played on the boat with, there was this, did you hear about this gig last year? The Central Park Conservancy. There was a brass sextet on a boat in Central Park. It was a little ridiculous, but that's how I met Gina Rebecca.
Money!
Yeah! And I like money. And I like money when I play my horn. So it was actually a lot of fun, and we sounded good together, the three of us playing, and there was actually a lot of women at that gig, because this was part of the female brass mafia of New York City. This is one of our gigs, so we got the kickback. But it happened to include a lot of women, and we were kind of looking around one day, and we were like, oh, there's a lot of women here. That's mm-hmm. kind of cool. A brass sextet gig that was randomly brought on a bunch of freelancers. Like, there's a lot of women. And so I asked them if they'd be interested in starting a group that happened to be all women players, and they were like, yeah, sure. And as we got together and started to figure out the vision of the group and what we were doing artistically, you know, that initial impetus of like, oh, I happened to find some women that I really enjoy playing with, now I can get this women's group together, okay, what are we going to do now? So it was an initial thought, but in our current, what would you say, the way that we are now, it's an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were first getting together, it was more of a, yeah, let's try to keep this in the girls' club.
Yeah. Well, and, and, you know, moving forward, artistically and direction-wise, we are dealing a lot, you know, of course, we're handling a lot of those things in-house, and I think that's really important, so we don't have, like, you know, for example, a male artistic director come in and coach an entire female group. I'm a little bit allergic to that idea. But that being said, you know, we're not shying away from collaborations with men. It's not like, oh, this is a girls' club and,
right.
no.
things like that. And even as we were building this this first production that we're doing, which is really about, it's about these stories that you already know, but the side of it that you hadn't really thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So, a perspective or somebody who's moving through life in a way that would be surprising to you. And we had a lot of conversations actually about, oh, so do we want to like approach gender in that? And we came to the conclusion that, you know, we don't really have to, because just by the very virtue of being on stage, being who we are, we're already making that point. We don't have to make that point. We can tell other people's stories because our story is so freaking obvious. Like, you know, it's
right.
It's not a thing. And
our
so,
story is being a group and having the show.
And, you know, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine who said, you know, like, all female groups piss me off or, you know, whatever. And I said, well, that's completely ridiculous because there are so many all-men groups. He goes, yeah, well, you know, but the majority of players are men and, you know, and what happens is they were just hanging out with each other, you mm-hmm. know, and then they ended. I was like, well, that's essentially what happened here. These were the yeah. people that were around, you know. And, you know, I think that our approach to it has really been to... We're not shying away from the fact that we're all women because we're aware that there are both positives and negatives to having those things. But, you know, his point was, well, you know, you're just trying to, you know, all female groups are just trying to use that as shtick or this or that or the other thing.
Listen, it's not my fault that we're gorgeous. Like, what do you want from me? I you know,
that's Kariaka's fault.
Right? That actually makes me... I used to feel bad about being a mildly attractive female and how that was probably advantageous. But I talked
but
to somebody one time.
It's also not advantageous because it's a double-edged sword.
Exactly. And they said, you know, why are you ashamed of... Everyone has a certain set of advantages that they're born with, whether it's the family that you come from and the amount of money they have... Whether your mother started you on trumpet lessons when you were 5, and so you have 10 years on everybody else that started at 15, that kind of thing. Why would you be ashamed of having an appealing physical appearance that might help you?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, yeah, music is, to focus in on one specific thing out of that,
mm-hmm.
Like, music is straight up just an expensive thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
For brass players, it's not as expensive.
Right.
Quite, but yeah, like, you know, you have a lot of people who are in a situation where they didn't always have to pay for their own stuff and can coast on daddy's dime for a few years after they finish school. I mean, that's not uncommon. I know plenty of people who have done that, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. It's frustrating for those of us who were never able to do that, but.
Right.
That's, you know, you, there's, I don't begrudge, well, sometimes I do, but I try, you know, like, it's, you try not to begrudge someone that they have a specific advantage, and,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know, like, to be completely honest, like, yeah, I've had that thought before, it's like, oh, that so-and-so, this specific person is, they get gigs because, they get this because, hot girl, and,
I get,
you know,
that. A lot, especially because there are so few bass trombonists
yeah.
who are women. Probably that's the, you know, ratio-wise, the least common, you know, in the
yeah.
brass world.
And
but
I'm not
the,
proud of having that thought, but it's...
But, you know that. So my point in bringing it up is that, and really, like I said, it is a double-edged sword because I've had a lot of instances in my life where people have straight up told me that they expected me to not be a very good player
mm-hmm.
based on how I looked when I came in. And these are people in really high places, people that ended up being really influential people for me eventually. You know, I had an instance where one of my bosses came up to me after I'd been working for him for maybe 4 years and said, you know, when you first walked into that first rehearsal and I saw you, I thought, oh no, we're in trouble. And then...
That's
and
nice.
Then we heard you play, and we were like, oh. And so, you know, one of the things that I think that gets glossed over when you talk about, oh, yeah, how it's an advantage, and one of the reasons that I think that it's so uncommon to see female brass players is that it only becomes an advantage after you can consistently exceed expectations that people have. For like what you might sound like.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a beginning or especially an intermediate player, so like fresh out of college or something like that, and you show up, people's expectations of you, if you look, people's expectations, well, I'll just, instead of saying generally, I'll talk about me because this is what I know. You know, when I show up to things, people often think that I'm going to be shy. They often think that I won't be professional. They think that I'm very young. They think that I must still be in college because they haven't encountered too many full-time professional women who play bass trombone, and especially not, you know, that also do modeling on the side. So, like, let's just throw that out there. Yeah. And, you know, the assumption is that I must not be good. And as an intermediate player, you know, when it should have been a safe place for me to be an intermediate player, that was actually a very difficult thing because the expectation was kind of low. And then when I didn't, like, far exceed that, a lot of times I got judged as worse than I probably actually was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? Now the expectation is really low. And so you kind of have that thing where, I don't know if you've ever, like, been to see a movie that somebody else is like, oh, that movie sucks, man. And, like, you know, you go to see the movie and actually you really love it.
Yeah.
Like, you might actually get a bump from that, you know, because you're like, because your expectation was so low. And so that, I think, is the benefit that I see now. But if I have a bad day,
you get tanked so much quicker.
Then I get, yeah. And not only do I get tanked so much quicker, everybody hears about it.
Yeah. Because
you know,
you're the only female, I mean,
because you're confirming their bias.
Right.
And that confirmation bias is really strong. And so up until the point where you can consistently trust yourself to knock that confirmation bias way out of the water that they're going to have, it can actually be a real challenge. And I think that that's one of the biggest reasons that we see so few women who become professionals in brass, in STEM, all of these things, because they're sort of not allowed to be, they're not allowed to make mistakes in the time frame when they need to make mistakes, early in the professional career, late in grad school, these sorts of things. And I think that, you know, because it's just, so if you make a mistake, it's because, oh, women aren't good at this. Do you know? And even if that's not consciously what someone is thinking, that's kind of the bias. So, for example, you know, when I won a couple of orchestral positions in the Seattle area, one with the Tacoma Symphony and one with the Spokane Symphony, which is a small full-time job. After I won the Tacoma Symphony, a lot of people, I was new to town at the time in Seattle, and a lot of people said, oh, well, she just got it because of the way she looks, even though it was primarily blind, you know. And that was the rumor that went around. And when I won Spokane, it was supposedly that I had slept with people. And that it was because I was hot, even though it was three blind rounds, even the finals were blind in Spokane. But then somebody actually, like, was upset about this, about my professional success, and actually, like, went and found pictures that I'd done, like, modeling pictures, topless pictures, and, like, shared them with brass players all over the United States.
That was nice.
It was really, really special. And, and, you know, my response to that was, of course, to go do more nude modeling shoots, because I was like, you know, fuck you. Like, you know, like, I'm like, well, there's two ways to respond to that. One's like, and the other is to go,
okay.
Showing everyone my great work.
You know, like, you know, the other one is to go, like, well, now it's ubiquitous, so you have no power. Congratulations, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
and I still have my job.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and so you get sort of those little things. And, you know, I mean, it's not as bad as it used to be. Don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not trying to say, oh, everything's such a challenge. I mean, they're, like, definitely now that I, you know, can consistently exceed people's expectations, there is a little bit of that bump because people pay attention to me when I show up, whereas they might not to somebody else. And then it's in my court whether or not that ends up being a good thing or a bad thing, you know? So, but just to say that full stop, that that's a positive thing, I think that that really ignores the experience of what happens before you become a consistently excellent player. And that ignores a lot of why we got into this, or why we continue to have, I mean, everybody knows why we have this, you know,
the imbalance,
but the reason we continue to have it is a lot more related to these smaller sorts of pushbacks that people feel where, you know, it's like they didn't get that experience because people didn't expect that them to be good, you know, so maybe somebody didn't call them for a gig because they didn't expect them to be good.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe that they had one bad day and now everyone in town heard about it. You know, these sorts of things, or they got a little less encouragement in graduate school because they weren't allowed to make the kinds of mistakes they would if they were flying under the radar.
Yeah.
You know?
And they're also not getting accurate feedback a lot of the times. Like, just an example of volume. You hear a lot in school when they're talking to, like, the entire class that, you know, trombones are known for playing too loud. So you don't want to be the trombonist that's always too loud and getting the hand. But when you're female and the conductor, like, asks you to play something louder, and then you're like, oh, I'll just bump it up one notch. Subconsciously in their head, they're like, I guess that's as loud as she can play. I've seen this happen a lot.
Yeah, I've experienced that as well. And so you almost have to consciously overdo it and have them then give you the hand. Like, if you get asked to, like, play louder, and especially orchestrally, if you get asked to play, like, louder, you almost have to be like, all right, I'm going to be a dick for a second.
Yeah.
You know? And let them be like, oh, okay, just good. Little less.
You know? Well, I mean, if people have heard you play, they know that the volume's not an issue.
For either one of us.
But we both had to learn that lesson the hard way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I mean, like, well, and you having played with me in some venues in which I definitely was not, shall we say, being tentative. You know, you will find the humor in this, where I've had many situations where I will show up to a gig and the first thing that will be said to me is, all right, now, you know, like, I know this is a different situation and everything, so don't be shy. And I'm always like, that's amusing. You know, that was maybe the wrong thing to say.
But yeah, imagine those experiences if you were still at the intermediate level.
Well, exactly. And I have examples of things like that as well. I'm sure we all do. And we know people have had these sorts of things. And I think that that becomes discouraging. And especially because it's not somebody who's saying, oh, you can't do this because you're a girl. Oh, you can't do this, you know, because it's not that overt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, and so
if it was that overt,
it would
be easier, but it would come under fire. Much
right.
quicker.
That's not socially acceptable.
It's just a thing where, like, on the surface, everyone is falling over them. You know, in our current society, for a public face, people, like, kind of fall over themselves to make sure that they don't look to the outside world like they're exclusionary.
Well, yeah.
But it's a more subtle and kind of insidious thing that's harder to root out because it has to do with, like, person to person biases and I mean, the overt stuff is still there. I mean, look at the at replies to any prominent female sportscaster, news anchor, really anyone who has any kind of public persona, and you'll see the overt stuff there. But like on a larger, like a broader scale, big organizations that pride themselves on their inclusivity still have issues on a person-to-person level.
Right. Well, and a lot of it is not conscious. Yeah. I don't know if you're like familiar with the research of Robert Rosenthal, but I think it speaks a lot to this. Robert Rosenthal was a social scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a series of experiments on, like, bias, experimenter bias and expectation and result. And so one of his most famous studies actually was he took a huge amount of rats, I don't remember, it's like 1,000 or something like this, rats.
They were the New York City subway system.
No, that's just 59th Street.
Yeah. And gave some of them pizza. No, I'm just kidding. And then we had pizza
and some, rat. And then some really cool
but,
turtle friends.
You know, they were all the same gender. They were all the same age. They were all tested to be at roughly the same intelligence. And so it was like about as homogenous of a test group of rats as you can get. He randomly assigned them into two different groups. Some he called smart rats and some he called dumb rats, basically. And what he did was he brought him in a bunch of researchers. And he told them, oh, I'm going to get you to get these rats to run a maze. And what you, so you have these rats that are really, really smart. They've been tested to be above average. And these rats are tested to be far below average, even though they were all the same rats.
I feel like I see where this is going.
But the interesting thing was, is that the rats that were randomly assigned brilliant rats outperformed the other rats on a factor of 2-1, which is enormous mm-hmm. result. And the reason was just the way, the subtle ways in which they were handled, because they were trying to be very, oh yeah, you know, do everything the same way, but it was the little things like, you know, handling the smarter rat with greater care when you put it down. And so when you look at the result that that sort of day-to-day contact has just with an animal that doesn't even really understand the concept that it's been labeled.
Yeah.
Has no ability to like grasp that. But it was little things like, you know, maybe they would stroke the rat that was the smarter rat to make sure that rat was calm. Mm-hmm. And so their idea that this was a smarter rat, therefore they produced that result by, you know, like, oh, you know, by doing subtle things that they weren't even necessarily consciously aware of. And I think this, they've shown that it also happens like in nursing homes, in elementary schools. You know, so if you tell a teacher, oh, this student is going to just really blossom this year,
you're going to spend more time in a subtle way. Like,
right. And so it might be like, oh, you know, I know that you can get this. And the kid will actually blossom.
Yeah.
Do you know? As opposed to, oh, okay, well, you didn't get it today. We'll try again tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like that asking a second time. And so, you know, you see this a lot in subtle ways. You know, I did, if you do a lot of teaching in schools, you can see this a lot in subtle ways where, like, you know, the band director might say, oh, you know, like, oh, take this solo to, like, a kid in a jazz band. And, like, if you start to notice, you notice that they call on the same kids a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even know they're doing it.
Right.
And, I mean, the truth of the matter is, there's no point in getting upset about it, right?
Right.
It's not like you can do anything about it. But being aware that that's a thing, and realizing that you have to set your own expectations for yourself and sort of shield yourself mm-hmm. towards that, I think is really important for like intermediate women to mm-hmm. hear. Because
well, and for band directors too.
Absolutely.
Don't even realize what they're doing. Maybe they're not calling on the girls because the girls are, quote, shy. I'm making air quotes. Can't see it. Because the girls are shy. But yeah, I mean, those sorts of things can really add up over time, like you're saying. Like something as small as no one expecting you to be good at what you're doing. Not everyone is going to rise to the challenge and be like, oh yeah, you don't expect this? Well, F you. And do,
especially
and do
not,
Jen Hinkle.
Especially
you know? You become a verb. But,
well, I mean, would you have done that when you were 12? Is that like your personality type? I mean,
no, I mean, honestly, the way that I am now has been a learned behavior.
Yeah.
And there were some very, 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 very difficult years for me early on in my development as a player, especially like the college years were really very awkward for me. And because I had a hard time seeing where I fit in. And feeling like I was good enough to be there. And I could never really put my finger on why until somebody pointed it out to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't all of it. I'm also kind of an awkward person, you know? but it did play into it and allowed me to look at it and sometimes go, oh, I see why this is happening.
Yeah.
And there's no point in getting upset about it. But I can do this and get around it,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and just having that sort of working knowledge allowed me to sort of reconstruct the way that I presented myself. And it allowed me to, you know, start to think of strategies that I could do to make myself appear more confident, both for myself, the benefit of myself, and for the benefit of others.
Yeah.
To sort of disengage from that a little bit.
It's funny. I think a common rejoinder to that would be like, well, didn't like all that like difficulty make you work harder and be better as a player or person? It's like, I mean, and that sure that might be the case, but wouldn't have just been easier to not be a dick during that time.
But I think that also speaks to why, not as many women players make it past the intermediate stage.
Right.
Because statistically, there's not going to be as many people that can go through that and emerge from the other side.
Well, I mean, how many trombone players do I know in this city? But how many female bass trombones am I familiar with?
And we're both
three.
Named Jen.
I mean, there's a total of three that I know.
Yeah.
And two of them are named Jen.
Yeah.
So like, anyway.
I think it's also interesting how different both of your experiences have been as compared to my own. Because I think horn
is a feminine instrument.
Horn definitely.
Quote,
well,
air quotes again, people.
Right.
Air
yeah.
quotes. I'm not like making a statement of fact.
But it takes a certain kind of crazy to play horn anyway. So we kind of self-sort. No, but I was the only female horn player in my high school. But then when I got to college, the tables turned, and I think someone will probably correct me that I was wrong. But I think at some point in my college studio, there were more female players than there were male players. So we had a pretty healthy mix. And then when I went to school in Las Vegas, there were more men around. But it wasn't quite the same stark contrast where I was constantly walking into places and being the only female.
Yeah.
Quite often, I would walk into somewhere and there would at least be one other. I mean, there's also more horns a lot of the times. But quite often, I would at least have one other woman in the section with me.
For something that you didn't want to be the main thing.
Yeah, I
just
know.
Like,
I
talking about it.
I
like,
start talking about Robert Rosenthal and I'm like, because I get all
rats,
excited.
Guys,
oh my god, pizza rats.
Yeah, you can feel free to like edit that
pizza.
Down to
yeah,
a very
I mean,
small.
I want it to be like, well, because part of the thing is that it was just, there's not that much that talks about it. So
mm-hmm.
like, it's important to have like,
okay.
I think it's important to talk about the elephant. You know,
he's
so.
Awful.
Gotta feed the elephant.
But let's talk about the show.
Yeah, let's talk about art and shit.
Yay,
art.
So
like
before we talk, I mean, because part of the reason like there was the scramble to get this in the can was because
mm-hmm.
you guys have a show coming up on the 25th.
Yes,
it's like your first major show as like a.
As sort of the ensemble that we're trying to become.
Yes,
yes.
As
yeah.
the
as
Calliope Brass
to,
unit.
As opposed to, hey, we're playing a wedding.
Yeah.
Which
can
is also
come,
fun.
But they might kick you out.
Please pay us money.
This is our show. We hope to take on the road.
Yeah.
Okay.
This
well,
is our, this is our production.
First off, like I want to talk about, like before we get into the specifics about the show,
mm-hmm.
which are really cool. I really am like really into that. But let's talk about like the kind of like we've touched on this a little bit, but like the kind of group aesthetic. Like we're talking about the multimedia, but like the five of you kind of come from similar backgrounds musically, but also like have like outlying characteristics. I mean, a lot of quintets are either just like guys trying to get in orchestras or guys who are in orchestras.
Yeah. See, that was our initial, when we first started meeting, that was a lot of what we talked about in meetings.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, no, I have no problem playing weddings, but if we actually want to like do this, we need an original business concept that we
right.
can take, you know? So we sort of have the 5-year plan and the this summer plan,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and that's kind of the way that we're organizing it. So, you know, but so this show, getting back to the show, is very much part of the 5-year plan,
right?
Exactly. You know, sort of what we're trying to create with
well,
the group,
right? I think before we get to that, we're
yeah.
going to get to that.
Oh yeah.
But I'm just talking about like, I mean. For this 5-year plan, like what kind of like are you going for like a specific sound concept? Are you like meld wise? I mean, this is kind of down in the weeds, like brass talk.
Right.
But I mean, there's like virtuosic. There's like great, you know, ideally, like, you want virtuosic, great blend, great sound, obviously, right, all that right. stuff, that's all standard, but, like, is there a specific thing you have in mind as far as your group sound and, like, things you want to do with that? Because you guys are all, like, freelance types, but, I mean, you spent, Aaron spent time, like, playing orchestral music in fucking East Europe. Jen is like a was an orchestral cat for a hot second, more than a hot second. But I know I've been in the freelance grind with Becca for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. Like mm-hmm. we all do these kind of things. Like, how does that all come together into making a unique statement?
To me, or do you wanna?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I think because we've only been married for 6 months, we're still in the honeymoon phase. I think that's, yeah, right? Oh my God. I think that's something that we're kind of in the process of figuring out, establishing a group sound. I think that it has become obvious that we're all interested in being versatile. We don't want to be limited to one. We don't want to say, like, oh, well, we're going to get, like, a really great, like, orchestral section sound. Nice, dark, whatever. Or we're only going to do jazzy things, or we're only going to do this. It's turned out that we naturally sound best on arrangements of Broadway, because why not? We're in New York. We play Broadway. But yeah, I mean, we certainly don't want to be limited to any one particular mm-hmm. thing, but because we're still kind of developing, I don't know that we've entirely established.
Well, it's always a process, no matter whether you've been together for 6 months or 6 years. Like, true. There's still developing. Will Lang's group, Load Bang, I mean, they've been together for 8 years, but, like, if you look at their sound after 3 years and their sound after 8 years, like, there's major differences, even though it's the same group of guys.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
Well, I think that there are certain ways that, you know, as you play together, you influence each other's playing. Mm-hmm. And that starts to take shape. I mean, you see that with symphony orchestra sections all the time. I mean, there's a reason that, like, New York has a sound and Chicago has a sound and all these things. I mean, yeah. Although now it's becoming the New York homogenous, like, eating every other sound across the country.
There's a reason New York sound bores a hole in the back of David Geffen.
But just being together and doing these sorts of things, you know, I was actually going to say a similar thing to Aaron, which is that I think that our strength is in the versatility of what our players have done and are doing. I'd really like to see us get to a place where we are able to move seamlessly through a wide variety of styles and sound concepts. Me personally, I really enjoy playing with a wide variety of sounds. So I enjoy being able to get a different sound that's more appropriate for whatever it is that we're playing. I think that to me is really a goal of where we're going. But, you know, in terms of what that actually ends up looking like when you get five people together, you know, that becomes a very organic process, and you influence each other in ways that you, I don't think, would initially expect, you know, mm-hmm. just in things like note lengths, articulations, how you are shaping a certain style of music. Mm. 'Cause you've got five different backgrounds, five different opinions of that. And so the way that those things start to combine becomes very interesting as time goes on. Mm-hmm. And even just in the, because we've been 6 months.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So, even just in 6 months, just the amount of growing that's happened from where we first started out, where we were very much like five individuals, mm-hmm. to now where we're starting to get a really homogenous, interesting sound, and things are starting to really transfer from player to player. And so you can hear these things start to, you know, pick up. Oh, okay, well, this person played it this way, and you can hear it go all the way around, and maybe next time it happens a different way, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of that sort of experimentation still going on, which I think is the hallmark of something really great being created.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're getting a lot more comfortable playing as a group.
Yeah.
We, like, for myself, I kind of know what each person's probably going to do. I feel like I can anticipate what's about to happen. You know, like if we're reading through a chart or if we're rehearsing something, like I know what to expect from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not like in a boring sense of like, oh gosh, they do the same
thing. Well, the bass trombone is probably gonna slow down.
Yeah.
Bitch.
Oh, hey, like, exactly.
That bitch.
To be fair, that's a bass trombone thing, not necessarily a Jen Hinkle thing.
That's true. She's living true to her instrument stereotypes, but
but you know, I gotta embody some of them,
right?
Because like, you know,
exactly.
It's important.
You might not look like a bass trombone on the outside, but you sure are on the inside.
Oh, that's
but yeah, I mean,
great.
we're really starting to be able to communicate a lot more quickly, quicker. We're communicating verbally a lot more quickly, and then also, you know, things are just starting to come together without.
Yeah. Well, and then also we have this like new wild card of on this particular concert, we have Sarah Mayo, who's sitting here joining us, because our founding member Andrea has a very busy performance schedule right now, which was not conducive to putting on a show of this magnitude.
Well, yeah,
you know,
you wrangle in the trombonist who has the fiddler on the roof chair. You're gonna have issues trying to schedule stuff.
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah, yeah.
At about the same time.
Because money.
Yeah.
And work.
Right.
Really
exactly.
Important.
And so it, you know. So for this first show, we have Sarah, who's been doing an absolutely fantastic job.
And Sarah, you just moved here like, what, 2 months ago now? 3 months ago?
I don't think we're sneaking up on three.
Yeah, because like I met you like, you had been here for like 3 weeks or something silly. Something silly, short amount of time. And I was like, who is this? I thought I knew all the girl trombone players.
Right. Who is this magical being with a red streak in her hair, descending from on high?
Or Seattle.
Yeah. It's technically higher.
A little bit.
Yeah. Anyway, so Sarah's doing this first concert with you.
Yes. And it's been very curious, like, you know, the difference just in adding one different member.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To how that influences the group. Because definitely they're... You know, not to say that there's anything better or worse, but there are differences.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It's amazing how just one different player, like,
right.
creates such a difference in the way that the whole group goes, you know? And so it's fascinating to me, you know? Cause,
to think that one out of five elements have changed and that it's significant enough to notice that much.
That you're like, oh, wow, you know, this feels different. And, you know, not like one way or another way is better, just like, oh, this is really different, you know? and so that's, I think, really getting to this point of like sort of just, oh, all right, how you influence each other, you know, as you go. It's really cool. I mean, I expected things to be a little different, but I didn't expect the whole sound to change the way that it did. You know, it was really fascinating.
And I think that just fosters a better and more interesting musical experience. If
mm-hmm.
Because if someone subs in an orchestral section, God, I'm just like hammering orchestras today. No,
you're
like,
on fire.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Well, this was my life. but no, like if someone subs in an orchestral section, it's probably going to sound basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like the person who is subbing will have been culled from a list of people who are on that list specifically because they can sound pretty much roughly exactly like who's already there, and they can fit in seamlessly, and it'll go. In a chamber group, because everything's so individualized, and especially in a chamber group, like in the sense that you guys are doing it, the way a single line gets phrased or someone takes a breath in this one spot instead of this other spot, or like the way I think about playing trombone in Sarah's case is different than the way Andrea thinks about playing trombone. Like it's just like this a huge ripple effect that influences the whole group, and I'm assuming the way what you're saying is meaning in a good way, you know. Like, yeah. Otherwise, you wouldn't have brought it up, right?
Right.
No, like in a positive way.
Trash talk me.
Yeah. Right. We're gonna shit talk Sarah while she sits
while
across from me on the, at this same table.
Ever since Sarah showed up, it's awful.
But yeah, it's because the balance is so delicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, well, and we kind of made a conscious decision that we wanted. Especially for the, like, you know, especially because of the nature of the show and the organic way of it all coming together, we really wanted her to have a voice if she was going to be in it.
We've danced around it enough. Let's talk about the show. April 25th.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's at a place somewhere in New York.
It's at a place somewhere in New York. It's at the Holy Trinity Church in Inwood. It's on 20 Cummings Street.
Which is the corner of
Seaman and Cummings,
which no one will ever forget, which is why I'm bringing
it
up.
It's off the Dyckman Street stop on the A train.
It just gets better.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a Dongan Place, like, right around, like, nearby, too.
Yeah, it's Dongan really, Place is Dongan. Right nearby.
Anyway, so
and
much.
And Sickles.
Wait. God damn it. Way to go. Way to go, Dutch people.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
It's a great situation. The priest is very nice. And they were really generous with the space. And it's a nice, it's a great space.
Yeah, well, and the appeal behind this particular space and the reason that we're doing it in this space is this space is really set up for the kind of thing that we're trying to do. So we're not going to have to, like, jink it around, you know. We did, like, sort of a tech run of this in, you know, a different space, which was a little more industrial. And it was really difficult because we've got all these multimedia elements. We've got, you know, live singers, we have recorded, like, voice, we have recorded video. Voice while going, recorded voice and video going on while we have, like, playing happening, we have piano, and so it just becomes...
pianos.
Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah, exactly. And so this space is really cool because it's already set up with a projector and a screen, it has a stage, so it's a true... auditorium built for this kind of thing. It's a theater, really.
Yeah.
And
there are two places to make music in this church. Some people might be familiar with the sanctuary because there's a concert series called Listen Closely that I think utilizes that space a lot. Mm. But we are in the theater.
Yeah. And was just a little more conducive, especially, you know, for a multimedia concert. And so, you know, and actually the sound there is quite good too. So it should be, a really, great setup.
So, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you're wanting to, with this concert, you're wanting to tell stories, but stories that you might know, but don't know as well as you think you do.
Yes.
In a way.
The B side of familiar stories.
The B side of familiar stories, and just present that and be like, hey, yeah, sure, this happened and that was a thing, but guess what? This also happened, and it's legitimately just as important as what you already know.
Right.
Am I summing this up correctly?
Yes. So just to provide a couple of specific examples, I don't want to give too much away about...
No, you have to give it all away.
Yeah. Spoilers! No.
Give it all away on the corner of Seaman and Cummings.
Exactly. But we've got some really interesting pieces. For example, we have many people who are brass, you know, followers, if you will, or brass fans will know the piece Morning Music, and many people have heard the vague description that he printed in when he on the original edition. That
this
he,
is by
David Sampson.
Great.
But that he had written, you know, for my brother who was killed by the KKK. And that's all that people knew. So what they don't know is that everyone, what we discovered, immediately assumes that he's black.
Of course.
You know.
Well, I mean,
And he's not. And his brother was killed... I'm trying to like dance around because I don't want to give too much of it away. But his brother was killed basically for union organizing, by the KKK. And there was a whole interesting, very interesting political, reason for that.
which we get into a little bit. And so this is presented very much like a documentary. We had a professional film crew and come in, and it's really, really powerful hearing him talk about this, because it there's so much more to this story than even I imagined.
Yeah.
Do you know? I interviewed him for this, and I got done, and I just sobbed. Right. It was just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And it's you know, so it's really powerful. And it's done by a filmmaker named Lorian Delman, who is a fantastic filmmaker, and edited by Morgan Metters, who has a lot of experience in documentary work. And so it's really very cool. And then we have another story from a film crew in Seattle that is about a trans man. And a lot of people, when they think trans, especially right now, there's a lot of controversy going on about the trans community. And what's in the media right now is very much about trans women. That is, someone who was born with an X and a Y chromosome who is female. As opposed to Cole, who is going to be telling his story, who was born with two X chromosomes, and he is male. And it's really fascinating to hear him talk about his experience, and especially to see him, because a lot of people, they don't think about these sorts of things. He's very, very male. You know, and in fact, when we did our tech rehearsal, we realized we actually have to give an intro to this, because so many people did not understand, looking at him and hearing him talk, why he was talking about this, because they did not realize that he was born with two X chromosomes.
Right.
And so we realized we have to actually give an introduction, because it's such it's very interesting, because people who are, especially these people who are like going at the rails of like, oh, well, you know, like you have to go to the, you know, the bathroom with the chromosomes that you were born with, or the genitalia that you happen to have, or that you were assigned depending on, you know, your situation. But they haven't considered someone like Cole. And it's like,
yeah,
really?
Because if Cole walked into a women's bathroom,
well, they assume
he'd be arrested they, until they
absolutely. Yeah, they assume that they can always tell. And but really, actually, Cole's story isn't even about that.
Mm-hmm.
What's fascinating, but that is certainly a part of it. And so again, it's not poking at this exact thing. It's this other thing of his, of feeling like the lesser part of the LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
Like the lesser quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And how that is really interesting with all the political stuff that's going on right now, and that has been going on this year with all the really big gains that have been made into like marriage equality and these sorts of things. And so it's a really fascinating look into being a, because he is a gay trans man. So he's a member of two different parts of this same acronym, if you will, and how that affects his experience. And it's fascinating to hear this story. One of the things that we've done is we've taken and woven music through this in sort of a Soldier's Tale-esque treatment, which adds a lot of power to what the words are saying. So there are periods of time where there's a little bit of music playing back, but then also going back and forth. And it's interesting in that way to take somebody's real life story and treat it like Peter and the Wolf or Soldier's Tale or these sorts of stories. But instead of being a fake story, this is someone's
life
experience,
right.
You know? And then we also have a story from David Huey, who is a fairly well-known opera singer as well as Broadway performer. He was on the Porgy and Bess National Tour. And he is talking about some of the challenges that he has faced being a black man singing traditional Italian opera. And it's really fascinating. But again, not exactly the story that you would expect.
Right.
And he's going to be also singing with us as well, a couple of songs that he thought were very complimentary. So it's a really kind of fascinating look, and we're trying to move through it musically. But if you're not somebody who would usually go out and watch a brass quintet concert, you still will probably enjoy this show because it's got a really unique narrative to it. And there's a lot of really fascinating stories. The video is so well done. We were really fortunate to have these people who believed in the project to donate their time and their energy to helping us get this off the ground.
Well, I mean, it's funny that with the thing you say about the audience and the brass quintet, it's less, when you get to a certain point, you transcend the medium and access the art.
Right.
Like, I mean, I studied with Dave Taylor for a long time. He's like my guy, but like, that's one thing we would always talk about is like, it doesn't matter that you're playing trombone or horn or trumpet or as a brass quintet, because that's just like the way you act. That's just your access point into what actually people relate to. Sure, there's people that relate to brass playing, and there's people that relate to orchestra playing, and there's people that relate to Broadway shows and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But what the large group, larger community of people want to hear is something that accesses an emotional place or an artistic place, no matter what it is that's producing. Whatever it is, no matter what the access point is,
right?
Is that am I
yeah, kind of getting into that? And I think that's really what we're trying to do. It's like, this is what we do, and this is what we have, and we're trying to create something really unique and to us. I mean, it's been very interesting trying to put it together, simply because there's not a model.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah, there is. She's playing bass trombone.
Right. All right.
Well played. But there's not this sort of a canon.
Template.
There's not a template for it. And so it's been really challenging, even just while we've been talking as a group, trying to make sure that everybody can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't say, oh, just it, we're doing this, you right. know, so it's like, okay, it's kind of like this, but with like this, and then
him. Well, I mean, you have to, like, to hook people, you have to create reference points.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it can be a struggle when there's something that's a little more amorphous.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and the way that really we've started to describe it is, it's like the moth or This American Life meets brass quintet playing Soldier's Tale-esque. You know, and so it's like,
yeah, totally. That
yeah, everything. Just like that, just like that. But really, what it is it's a show.
Yeah,
right. It's not, and so one, and that right. was a really yeah. big point where we realized we cannot call this a concert, we cannot call this a recital.
Yeah, no, right. it's neither of those things
because
yeah.
it's its own thing, and the closest thing is a show. It's mm-hmm. It probably has more in common with a Broadway show than it does with a brass quintet recital. Only it doesn't.
A lot less singing and dancing though.
There is some singing though.
There is no dancing.
There
Trust
is
me.
No
I
dancing.
I want to see that. I will not dance for anyone.
Then,
but to like pull on all the traditionals, you're finishing up with Ewald, right?
We probably should do that for an encore.
That would be pretty funny. That would be pretty funny.
Right.
I mean, the only piece that we're playing, I think, that's been done by a brass quintet, by a professional brass quintet, is Morning Music.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing a piece by David Mislanka that I think has had maybe one or two performances, mm-hmm. but
yeah,
it's not a quintet piece, it's a quartet piece. So poor Aaron doesn't get to play. We're just ignoring her.
Well, there's piano. I was going to try and play the piano part, and then I looked
and
at it.
And then you realize that it's just...
Yeah,
it was like that piano basic competency test didn't really cover like full range arpeggios.
If it was the first couple movements, I would have been fine, but then
But then the third movement happened, and you're like, fuck you. Dude, yeah.
Well, there was all those 16th note septuplets. I was like, it's not happening.
Yeah.
No thanks.
So we have, oh yeah, and I should mention, our pianist,
Sarah.
What her last name is.
I know it, but I can't
think I know. It. This is what happens.
This is bad. It's on the poster. That's why it's on the poster. Because I couldn't remember. I want to say, no, David is Huey, and Sarah is...
Hold on, just let me look it up.
I'm so sorry, Sarah. We love you.
This is all going to get cut out. Who gives a fuck?
Okay.
Nope. God. Okay, no. Where's there we go. There it is. Where the fuck is this poster? Who runs the social media? Yeah.
What?
Sherman.
Sherman. Sarah Sherman.
So the pianist is...
The pianist is Sarah Sherman.
Yeah.
You should say it.
I should say it? Okay. Well, yeah. So we have piano playing by Sarah Sherman, and we're going to be utilizing that on two different pieces.
Mm-hmm.
We have one of the arrangements that we're doing with David Huey will also feature Sarah as well.
And so our arranger is...
Dan Pardo.
He is wonderful.
Yeah.
He's been super cool.
I hear Dan's are kind of awesome.
Gosh. Dan's and David's galore.
And Sarah's.
Shows.
And celiacs. We've got some serious synchronicity going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of gluten-free people on this show.
Like, actually, it's amazing.
Don't say that. That means people will start hating you.
Hey, I was gluten-free before it was trendy. I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah.
I was gluten-free like nine years ago.
We're all celiacs. Like, we're the real deal.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're like the medical kind, you know? Like, we're not the,
I feel like a little bloaty when I eat bread. I was like, well,
but
yeah,
but I still
it's
drink beer. You know? Yeah, no.
Is butter a carb?
Rude.
Actually, there was a kind of funny thing, like synchronicity with this show. We have David Mislanka, David Sampson, David Huey. We thought about just renaming the show "Songs of David."
Yeah,
that was really funny.
But we have Sarah on trombone, Sarah on piano. We have three celiacs in the group,
but I'm the only one named Aaron.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah, but everyone just assumes you're an actor from Breaking Bad, so
you
got that
what?
Going.
He's a Hebrew male, I'm an Irish female. Those names are very different.
not in the ear balls there, aren't.
I know. It's
you should start going by like Erin.
Erin. There's no nicknames for Erin. It's like Air. There was a girl in my middle school that went by E. That feels weird.
I could call you Rin.
Rin Rin.
But then people would think you were Japanese.
Until they saw me. They'd be like, all right, no, this is getting weird. Since when are Japanese people?
Be like, oh,
naturally blonde.
Yeah.
Rin belongs in an anime.
Right.
Or a manga.
I wish. My boobs aren't big enough.
Going after them.
But anyway.
But to like kind of sum everything up.
We left off One Piece. We're not talking about... We forgot to talk about In the Heights.
Oh, yeah. You want to talk about
it? I mean, that makes sense. In the Heights. Do you all live in Washington Heights?
All except for Sarah. One.
She's out in Crown Heights. But she's still in a height. She's in Crown Heights. It's close enough.
Fair enough.
Yeah. She's in one
practically
of the heights.
The same.
I live in Inwood. It's not Washington Heights, technically. But I do live on the same street that Lin-Manuel Miranda grew up on. And it's my favorite thing to tell people about Payson Avenue.
Nice.
But Dan Pardo arranged that for us too, and it's a really awesome suite from that show.
Yeah, well, I mean, Washington Heights and Inwood, it's still like heavy Dominican, whether you're in Washington Heights or whether you're in Inwood. So,
yeah.
I mean, the underlying concept still works.
Yeah, but Inwood has a lot more trees.
That's true.
We've got that nice big park.
Yeah. But so. April 25th, 7 p.m., Holy Trinity Church, 20 Cumming Street, and it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Right? There are no tickets. You show up.
You donate money.
You donate money if you feel like it. If we're awful, you can leave in a huff. I'm kidding. Totally kidding.
No, we're locked
in. I mean, you could,
yeah.
I guess.
No one's going to stop you. I'm going to raise my eyebrow and judge you a little bit.
There's going to be some judgment. But if you were to do that, you wouldn't get to stay for the wine.
Ooh.
There's wine involved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had to
make you bribe the priest a little bit, but
no. That's not true.
I'm kidding.
No, I'm sure he's the guy who sold you the wine.
Right.
Like, it's already there.
Actually, though, it's great because apparently, like, his 12-year-old son does all the lighting for the Pied Piper's Children's Theater. And he was like, oh, can I do you guys need lighting? Can I do the lighting? We're like, sure. Yeah. So, lighting by the priest's 12-year-old. Which actually, I'm really excited about.
Yeah,
I really am. He's gonna have adult assistance, yes. But yeah,
we're
I
great.
Think that's
we're happy to
super
have
great.
But yes, there will be a wine and maybe cheese reception afterwards.
Yeah, and so that way to console you from having an entire brass quintet hour go by without having any Ewald. Well, dry your tears.
Yeah, no. But yeah, it sounds fucking great.
Yeah.
So
we're really excited.
Aaron, Sarah, Jen, thank you for coming and sitting down with me.
Thank you for having
and
us.
And thank you to Jean and Rebecca in absentia for being awesome because they are.
They are, it's true.
Awesome.